This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Özlem Onaran is Professor of Workforce and Economic Development Policy at the University of Greenwich in London. Her research interests include globalization, crisis, income distribution, employment, investment, development, and gender. Joe Michel is studying for his doctorate under Jan Toporowski at SOAS, University of London. He's currently investigating, I understand, the relationships between money, finance, saving, and investment in China. But I've no doubt that he's very familiar with the economics of Kletski and other Polish economists, and will be able to help us engage with Özlem's talk. So thank you very much, both of you, for travelling up for the seminar. And over to you, Özlem.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure and a privilege to talk here in the Keynes seminar series. Let me briefly mention the background of the paper I'll be presenting today. This is part of a project that we have done for the International Labour Office, and it has fed into their Global Wage Report published in December. So the question ILO was interested in was, what is happening to wage share? There's a fall in the wage share, why it has been falling? It was another project. And this one I'll present today is about what happens to growth when the wage share, the share of labor in national income, falls at both the national level and the G20 countries, large developed and developing countries, as well as at the global level. So the theoretical question is whether aggregate demand moves along with the wage share or in an opposite direction, whether it's wage-led or profit-led, and I'll come back to these definitions in a minute. The implicit question that we were all interested in was the policy implications of that. Would there be a recovery out of the global recession based on an improvement or a reversal of the fall in labor share and national incomes across the world? And to cut a long story short, the good news is that yes, there is actually a material background to come out of the crisis to improve our global economic performance in terms of growth and job creation by improving income equality, by improving the share of labor in national income. The bad news is it is an issue of global macroeconomic governance, which is obviously tricky. This piece that I'm presenting today is quoted work with Yorgos Galanis, who was the research assistant for the project for ILO. So I'll briefly walk you through the stylized facts of the share of labor in national income, and then present the model that we are using to analyze the effect of a change in income distribution, functional income distribution, on growth, and then present our estimation results, which are for G20 countries, actually to be precise, 16 of the G20 countries for which long time series for the wage share is available. I'll not be able to present the details of the available empirical literature, which looks at predominantly to European countries and other advanced capitalist countries in the world. However, the new thing about this piece of research is not to look at just the national effects for each country, but to look at the global interactions. To be precise, the question we are ultimately interested in is, what happens to global growth when there is a simultaneous change, simultaneous fall, to be precise, in the share of labor and income in the major economies of the world? And the effects then work not just to the effects at the domestic level or just isolated effects on export performance of the country, but there are also effects that comes through changes in the profit share or wage share of the trade partners of each country that in turn affects the import prices, relative export and import prices for each country, and that affects of obviously the GDP in the trade partners, thus the demand for exports of each country, and that will have then interesting additional effects on top of the national isolated effects of isolated changes in the rate share. And hopefully I will have some time to elaborate on the policy implications of the results. So just to start, a few basic definitions. When I talk about income distribution throughout the paper, I will be talking about functional income distribution, and in that sense, GDP, to be precise, GDP at factor cost, is distributed in terms of wages and profits. Wages in this paper are defined as adjusted labor compensation. That means it adjusts for the labor income of the self-employed. To be precise, it's compensation per employee times total employment, assuming that the self-employed people also have the same average wage as a salaried employee. This correction is particularly important for the developing countries in the work we are doing, where informal employment is an important component of total employment, and most informal workers are recorded as self-employed. So accounting for their wage income, labor income, then is important. In that sense, we are also making an adjustment to profit income. R will be standing for not simply operating surplus, but it will be adjusted gross operating surplus. What is left from GDP at factor cost when we deduct this adjusted labor compensation bill, if you like. In that sense, throughout the paper, when I talk about adjusted profit share, I'll mean adjusted gross operating surplus as a ratio to GDP at factor cost. And wage share will be also adjusted wage share. In that sense, it will be simply 1 minus adjusted profit share. So this is just a brief feeling of the data behind the whole study. Adjusted wage share for first advanced capitalist countries in G20 from 1960 to 2007, deliberately we are leaving the observations after the crisis aside, because that's a serious break in terms of the behavioral relationships we will be estimating, and we simply don't have enough data points after the crisis to test for possible break points. And this is adjusted wage share, where the value for 1960 is indexed to 100, just to avoid international comparison problems due to the differences in national accounting systems of different countries. So what do I have here? I'll have euro area as one aggregate economic area, as well as the large eurozone countries in Europe, Germany, France, Italy, and other large advanced G20 countries like the UK outside the eurozone, and US, Japan, Canada, and Australia. If you try to make sense of the seemingly complicated picture here, for example, if we look at the euro area in aggregate, it's very clear that starting from late 70s, early 80s onwards, there's a strong secular decline in the share of labor and national income. This is something that adds up to more than 10 percentage points of decline in the share of labor. The story is similar for all the other countries. The decline is slightly more modest in the US and the UK. But mind you, my data, labor compensation data, also includes managerial wages, which are in national accounts, part of labor compensation. If I could correct for that, the fall in labor share in the UK or US would probably be comparable to that in the euro area. And it's an interesting topic, but a topic of another study. Particularly, I'm interested in using data that I can compile for both the developed and developing countries within G20. Therefore, I'm not doing adjustments that I can do only for, say, one or two countries in this paper. That is the same data of adjusted wage share, this time for the developing countries in the G20, Turkey, Mexico, Korea, Argentina, China, India, South Africa. Brazil, which might interest our colleague here, sadly is not part of the study because I don't have long time series for Brazil for wage share. The data starts only after 1989. Similarly, Russia is not also here for lack of long time series. Here my data starts again from 1970 this time, and it's indexed to 100. The secular fall in the wage share is also prominent here. There are a few ups and downs, like in the case of Turkey and Argentina, which are related to currency crises and the episodes of boom prior to currency crises, where white shares, there is an area of maneuver for labor to offset part of the losses in white share during the structural adjustment periods during those boom years. And when the currency crisis hits, it's of course very dramatically reversed. And if you take out these extreme ups and downs, the big picture is again that there has been a secular decline in labor share. So this simultaneous decline is the most important motivation behind this work. What is the outcome or consequences of that simultaneous race to the bottom in labor share in both the developing and developed countries across the world in the post-80s in terms of growth performance? Just to give you a feeling of stylized facts, what has happened to growth in each of these countries from 60s to 70s, these are average growth rates in GDP in each decade from the 60s to 2000s. In the advanced capitalist countries, the picture is quite uniform. Growth in each decade in the post-80s has been lower compared to 60s and 70s. And mind you, this declining growth performance, stagnant growth rates or lower growth rates are going in parallel to a declining labor share. And that's puzzling from a mainstream point of view, which sees wages or labor income simply as a cost, which means a decline in labor share, an increase in profit share, was supposed to stimulate investments, enhance growth and job creation, and it would generate those trickle-down effects. That doesn't seem to be supported with simple stylized facts of growth here. The story in the developing world is slightly more complicated. The decline in average growth rates, particularly in the 80s and 90s, in countries like Turkey, Mexico, even Korea, compared to 70s, is also a picture similar to the developed countries, but there are some notable exceptions, like China, India, and later in the 2000s, South Africa, where growth rates improved significantly. And in Argentina, if we leave out the lost decade of 80s, growth performance also seems to have improved in the 90s. And in these countries, it looks like a fall in the wage share has been accompanied by at least not weaker growth performance. Certainly this is the case in China and India. So what does that say about the relationship between labor share and growth? What does the theory tell us? This is just a very brief introduction to the macroeconomics about the effects of income distribution on growth. So what would be the effect of a wage cut, or in my case, a fall in wage share, on aggregate demand? As I said, most of the work about that would be concerned with effects at the national level, within national boundaries. And what we will try to contribute here is to look at the global effects by taking into account the simultaneous race to the bottom in terms of the wage share. If you like, from a mainstream or a classical perspective, the effect of a fall in labor share is supposed to be positive because wages are merely a source of cost. The model we are working with is a post-Keynesian, neo-Kaletskian model, and in those models, wages are not just a cost item, but they have a dual role. They are also a source of demand. And in that sense, a fall in the wage share, thus correspondingly an increase in the profit share, will have both positive and negative effects on aggregate demand. Most importantly, the effect on consumption is unambiguously negative. Why? Because empirical evidence, as we will see in a minute, is very unambiguous that marginal propensity to consume out of wage income is larger than that out of profit income. So when you redistribute from wages to profits, domestic consumption is for sure to fall. So that's one negative effect. What happens to investment? Obviously, a fall in the wage share, an increase in the profit share, is a positive stimulus in terms of profitability to domestic private investment. So there will be a positive effect coming from there. But mind you, that effect is partial, because investment is not just about profitability, but it's also about prospects of sales, the prospects of demand, and thereby the net ultimate effect will be more complicated than that. But now I'm only interested in the first round, if you like, prior to multiplier, direct partial effects. Hence, there is a positive effect on investment due to a fall in the wage share. Exports and imports will be affected as well. Obviously, wage share is very much linked to unit labor costs that affect export prices, relative prices. Thus, I would expect exports to increase due to a fall in the wage share, which means a fall in unit labor cost, and imports to decrease. Thus, net exports will for sure increase, unambiguously increase, due to an increase in the profit share and a fall in the wage share. So here I have one negative effect on consumption and two positive effects on investment and net exports. If I sum up these, the total effect is, the sign of the total effect is ambiguous. If that sum happens to be negative, this is a regime that we will call a wage-led demand regime in this Nikoletskian model. If it happens to be a positive sum, if the total effects of a cut in the wage share is positive, overall that will be a profit-led demand regime. Thus, an increase in the profit share stimulates aggregate demand. And what neoclassical economics, or if you like, mainstream conventional orthodox policy assumes is that all the economies are profit-led. So that is the major policy stance or the origins of the neoclassical policies that have basically relied on wage competitiveness as a core aspect of increasing growth and employment performance. However, as you see here, the summation can well be negative, thus a fall in the wage share may lead to stagnation in demand if the demand regime is wage-led. The most novel theoretical contributions in that area goes to Baduri and Marglin, and prior to that, contributions by Dutt and Blicher are building on the original ideas of Kaletsky. So what we do in the paper is to bring that theoretical framework into empirical terrain. We are basically estimating individual behavioral functions for each country separately for each component of aggregate demand. So starting with consumption, we are estimating consumption as a function of labor income, adjusted labor compensation, and profit income. And obviously, what we are expecting is to have a higher marginal propensity to consume out of wage income compared to that out of profit income. There are several corrections we are making in the estimations to account for possible differences in marginal propensities to consume in the rural versus urban settings by integrating the share of agriculture, particularly for the developing countries. This is a detail we can discuss if you're interested in it. The next behavioral equation we are estimating is about the private investment demand. So private investment is estimated as a function of GDP, that's simply to reflect the accelerator effects, and a function of the profit share. Again, we are trying to test whether public investments, government investments, make a difference in terms of private investment behavior. And also we are trying to correct for the share of agriculture, because investment is a different animal probably in the rural setting than in the urban setting. The estimations about the foreign demand effects are slightly more complicated because trying to estimate exports and imports directly as a function of the wage share sounds like a good shortcut strategy, but it simply doesn't work if you try to estimate these equations econometrically. You want to go through the behavioral equations separately in a stepwise approach. So what we are doing is to estimate domestic prices as a function of nominal unit labor costs, a simple markup pricing theory in the background, and import prices. Similarly, we estimate export prices as a function of the same variables. Then we go and estimate exports and imports as a function of relative prices, and in the case of exports, the income of the rest of the world, and imports, it's a function of home GDP. Only then, by using the parameters we estimate in those four behavioral equations, we are going back and trying to calculate using a chain derivative the impact of wage share on export as a ratio to GDP and similarly on imports as a ratio to GDP. And there are a few details that I will skip for now in the sake of time. Now, so far, the estimation strategy I have talked about is something that we have done or other colleagues have done for individual countries separately. For example, Engelbert, myself, and Stefan Ederer have estimated a similar model for the euro area in aggregate. Other colleagues, Eckhard Hein and Vogel, Nastepat and Storm have estimated these for individual countries in Europe. We have looked at the US and our colleagues have done similar estimations. What is new in this paper is to take the parameters from each individual country's estimation and try to look at the global interactions. So what are we doing here? We are thinking of a simultaneous change in the profit share in each country. These may differ in magnitudes if you want. And this will generate a change in the growth rate in each country. Part of the effects will come through the effects on private demand. So summing up the effects on consumption, these are the marginal effects calculated using the elasticities that we estimate in each behavioral equation. So the partial effects on private demand would come through effects on consumption, private investment, and net exports, which is exports minus imports. And then, however, there will be also direct partial effects that come via changes in import prices in each country. Remember, exports and imports are all functions of relative prices, export or domestic prices relative to import prices. Now, when profit share changes only in my country, my import prices will be obviously constant. It will be ceteris paribus. It would suffice if I look at only the effects of profit share change in one single country. However, if it's changing in all countries simultaneously, my import prices will also change because obviously my trade partner's export price is a function of labor costs, hence wage share, hence profit share. So this change in trade partner's profit share will have effects on both exports and imports. And in case of each country, this effect will be weighted by the relevance of that particular trade partner in the total imports of each country. So this is, if you like, the second matrix here. And then both of these effects will have multiplier effects. The first matrix down here is, if you like, the domestic multiplier effects, the simple Keynesian multiplier. When private demand changes due to changes, immediate changes in consumption, investment, and net export, they will have multiplier effects on, again, consumption, private investment via the accelerator effect, and on imports, obviously. So this is the domestic Keynesian multiplier matrix. And then, obviously, changes in my trade partner's GDP will have effects on my exports, depending on the elasticity of my exports to rest of the world's GDP. And for the case of each trade partner, that effect is weighted by that trade partner's GDP in my total, in the world GDP. So if I solve, if you like, this matrix to find out the effect of a change in the profit share in each country on growth overall in each country, I get what I can call a global multiplier effect. So there is the domestic effects, direct effects of private excess demand, and then there are the effects that come through the changes in the import prices, and all that effect triggers domestic multiplier effects as well as global demand effects. If I were ignoring those global interactions, these two components would disappear, if you like. So what do we do in terms of the econometrics? As I said, we estimate single equations for each behavioral function I have mentioned, consumption, investment, export prices, domestic prices, exports and imports for each country separately. We look at leg structures as well, so we don't just use contemporaneous variables, but we use the first legs, and we start with a general model, and eventually we come down to a specific model where we are keeping only the significant variables, contemporaneous or legged variables. We are, since most of our variables have unit root, we are testing for the presence of a long-term error correction mechanism. So if there is co-integration, we do estimate error correction models. If there is no significant co-integration, then we stick with short-run estimations in differences only. So we have annual data for the advanced capitalist countries back to 60s and for the developing countries back to 70s. The data sources are straightforward for the advanced capitalist countries, AMECO and OECD. For the developing countries, it's quite more complicated than that. So if anyone is interested in the details, I'm happy to discuss. I will not have time to show you individual estimation results. I have them in the slides, and if you want to look at anything particular, we can go back to them in the discussion. But I will only present the summary results. So if you look at the effect on consumption first, this is just the effects on the advanced capitalist countries at the moment. As you see, in all countries, the effect of a fall in the wage share, if you like, a 1% rise in the profit share, is negative. That's something I was expecting. I'm not surprised. Other people have found the same. And the differences, that would signify the differences in marginal propensities to consume. It's something that ranges from, say, 50% to 25%, which makes quite a lot of sense to me. The interesting thing is the effect on investment is positive, as I would expect. There's only the US where there's no significant effect of profit share on private investment. There's an explanation behind it, which we elaborated in a different paper. But so for now, I'm skipping over that. The interesting thing is, if you look at domestic private demand, thus the effect of a rise in the profit share on consumption plus investment only, in all countries, the effect, negative effect on consumption is dominating the positive effect on investment. Thus, if there were no exports and imports, private demand would have been wage-led. Thus, a cut in the wage share is only creating a contraction in demand simply because the private investment effects are not strong enough. But of course, there are positive effects that come from exports, some decrease in imports, so overall net exports are increasing when there's a cut in the wage share. If I sum up the effects on consumption investment plus net exports, I get the total effect on private excess demand. And if this is negative, the regime is called wage-led. But you can see here, for example, in the Eurozone, 12 countries of the old Eurozone, a 1 percentage point increase in the profit share leads to a 0.08% decrease in private demand as a ratio to GDP prior to multiplier effects, that is. So Eurozone as a whole is wage-led, so is Germany, France, Italy, and the UK, and two other large advanced capitalist countries, US and Japan. It's only Canada and Australia who are profit-led regimes, and this is not surprising, because in these countries, domestic demand is also wage-led, but the net export effect is quite strong. Why? Because these are small open economies. In these countries, the positive effect that comes from exports is a lot more important than, say, in the Eurozone, which is mostly a closed economy. Most of Eurozone's trade is intra-European trade. Eurozone does not trade a whole lot with the rest of Europe. Thus, when you cut the wage share, you're left mostly with the negative effects on domestic private demand, since there is not much support coming from foreign demand in a relatively large closed economy. The effects on the developing countries are here. The result that says the effect of a wage share decrease is negative on domestic private demand holds also for all these large developing countries. That's a very robust finding. when you look at the total effect, you know, I have this time only two countries, Turkey and Korea, which are wage-led. The other developing countries are profit-led. And I have some very remarkable cases here, like China, which is very profit-led. Thus, a decrease in the wage share is leading to a strong stimulus on private demand in China. And this effect is not coming from a stimulus to private investment. Mind you, this is private investment. It's actually not significantly related to profit share, but it's coming from an unforeseen strong effect on net exports, which has something to do with the very labor-intensive nature of their exports and a very high price elasticity of their exports. We can discuss the details later, but I'll try to proceed with the global results. This is just an illustration of the multiplier effect. So what I have shown to you so far was just the direct effects before the multiplier. So there is a domestic Keynesian multiplier mechanism of a change in private demand on consumption, investment, and imports. And if you combine the elasticities and calculate the multiplier, which has been a concern of the IMF as well recently, so if you like, the multipliers that we are finding in this study are ranging between, say, 1.2 to 2.2. So they are greater than 1 in all countries, as I would expect, and in some countries quite remarkably high. Okay, so this last slide about the empirical results is summing up the results. The first column here is what you have already seen. A cut in the wage share, 1 percentage point increase in the profit share, and its direct effects on private demand in each country. That was something you have seen in the previous slides. The second slide is this column multiplied by the Keynesian domestic multiplier, which means it's just the effect of an isolated fall in the wage share in each country, and there is no accompanying fall in the wage share in other countries. But as we know, profit share has fallen actually simultaneously, wage share has fallen simultaneously in all countries. So the last column would basically combine all the effects that come from changes in import prices of the trade partners and demand in the trade partners. The column in between is before looking at the global multiplier effects, thus changes in trade partners' GDP, just incorporating on the first column the effects that comes from the changes in my trade partners' profit share. So if there's a simultaneous increase in the profit share, a simultaneous decrease in the wage share, by about 1 percentage point in all these 16 countries, what happens to private demand in each of the countries? As you can see here, the negative effect in the euro area, for example, gets, of course, stronger. Why? Because any export gains Europe could make out of a decline in the wage share is now moderated because it's not just Europe, but also the US and China and Canada who are decreasing their wage shares simultaneously. So the negative effect gets stronger. Now, two countries do an interesting thing here at this stage. Canada, which was originally a profit-led country, and India, which was also a profit-led country, starts contracting now in a scenario of race to the bottom. Why? Because when Canada decreases its wage share, when it's the only game in town, it could grow out of that strategy because it was a profit-led country in isolation. But when Canada is accompanied by Mexico and the US in the same game of race to the bottom, Canada's export advantage is wiped out. So export demand disappears, the boost to export demand disappears. So Canada starts contracting. So does India, if the Indian wage competitiveness policy is implemented also in China, Turkey, Mexico, and the US and Europe simultaneously. And the last column is simply adding on top of that the negative effects that will come from the fall in trade partners' GDP. And here, two more countries join this group of profit-led countries in isolation, which, however, can't grow out of a race to the bottom. This is Mexico and Argentina, as I would expect. when I present the results that says Mexico and Argentina are profited countries, my Latin American colleagues are never convinced because they say, in the post-80s, we have been decreasing wages, but growth has been much more stagnant than before, so that can't be true. It's correct what you're saying. It's simply because wage share did not fall just in Mexico, but it fell in Canada, in the US, and India, and Turkey at the same time. And so did it in the other Latin American countries. Obviously, if it were only Mexico, my results suggest that Mexico could be a profit-led model. However, it can't because profit share is simultaneously decreasing in all these countries. So as a result, in a global race to the bottom scenario, large advanced capitalist countries like the Euro area, UK, US, Japan, as well as Canada, and some major developing countries, not just Turkey and Korea, but also Mexico, Argentina, and India, happen to be wage-led. Thus, when the wage share decreases simultaneously, growth rates are lower in these countries. There are three countries remaining, that is Australia and most importantly China and South Africa, who can grow still in a race to the bottom setting. But overall global GDP, everything else being constant, or if you like global growth rate, would be lower by 0.36 percentage point when there is a race to the bottom by 1 percentage point. Obviously, as you have seen in the figures, wage shares have fallen by orders of magnitudes of 10 percentage points. So overall, the negative growth effects are a lot more than that. To reverse the scenario, would there be a way out of the crisis by improving the share of wages? So that is just one scenario that we are simulating in the paper. What if we reverse the share of labor back to the levels of late 70s, back to their peaks, in the originally wage-led countries like the Euro area, Turkey and Korea, UK, US and so on, and let some area of maneuver to increase equality in countries like Mexico, Argentina, India, Canada, which are profit-led in isolation, but in a race to the bottom scenario, who shift to wage-led regimes, and maybe just a much more limited area of maneuver for China and South Africa in terms of reversing inequality. What would happen to growth rates? For example, Europe could, or euro area could, grow out of such a wage-led recovery by some additional 2.4%. And let's say in the UK, there would be some growth advantage of a simultaneous wage-led recovery by some 1.9%. And overall global GDP would increase by some 3% if there is a complete reversal in inequality in at least some major large economies. So to conclude, the results very robustly suggest that domestic private demand, thus consumption plus private investment, is wage-led, and that's a very robust finding for both the developed and developing countries. In particular, large, hence relatively closed economies are rather wage-led. Thus, there is room for egalitarian policies that would improve the share of labor without harming long-term growth potential. So if you want to formulate it in very conservative terms, at least egalitarian policies won't do any harm to long-term growth, although the effects in isolation are not very large, obviously, and it doesn't rule out the relevance of other growth-enhancing policies like fiscal policies. The global simulation results are quite interesting, and they highlight the limits of international competitiveness strategies based on wage competitiveness in a highly integrated global economy. And in particular, it's important to bear in mind that some countries which might look like they're profit-led in isolation actually may start contracting in a global race to the bottom setting, like Canada, India, Mexico, or Argentina. The same applies to small economies which are part of the Eurozone. Austria and Netherlands could grow out of an isolated policy of wage competition, but when Germany and France and Italy all do the same, play the same game, then they can't grow out of that strategy. And most importantly, the results show it's just another indication of the famous fallacies of composition. The macro and micro results are not inconsistent, and you can't add up micro results in the sense that for a single firm, an increase in the profit share might be a good thing to increase sales, and it may even increase employment. But if you add up across the firms in the macro level, when all the firms are decreasing their shares of their wage rates, obviously that would lead to a contraction in demand and generate less growth. So each firm would like to have low wages at the firm level, but would love to have other firms paying higher wages, because there is a conflict at the micro and macro level. Similarly, in the nation and the global level, the results again don't add up. So for a single country, it could grow out of a fall in the wage share, but when all the countries do the same, there is a contraction in global demand. These all point at the relevance of macroeconomic policy coordination, in particular wage policy coordination, and the importance of avoiding beggar-thy-neighbor policies, which of course has quite important policy lessons about mainstream policy and the European Union at the moment. It also has consequences for development policies. Obviously, developing countries in isolation might be profit-led, but there is room for them to implement wage-led or pro-labor policies, in particular if they engage in South-South cooperation, thus try to form larger economic areas, which also tend to be more wage-led. And for the labor unions and the North, if they're interested in improving labor standards and wages in the developing countries to avoid harmful competition that comes from wage dumping policies, it would be important to begin policies at home by improving wages and labor standards first at home, and that would then leave a lot of space for developing countries to improve their wages. Obviously, in isolation, it's very hard for Mexico to improve wages when Canada and the US and Europe is engaged in strong wage competitiveness policies. And lastly, obviously, the results do point at the existence of a material basis for a recovery based on improving the share of wages, which would also reverse income inequality, which has been one of the most important reasons behind this crisis. You could tell me, or you could ask me, whether there is a limit to how much wage share can increase, particularly in a capitalist economy. And then I would suggest reading Kalitsky's Political Economy of Full Employment. Obviously, there is a limit to full employment and improving wages in a capitalist setting, which could, maybe from a Marxian point of view, lead to this time a profit squeeze, and that could be a different reason of the crisis. So if you like, we are now in an episode of realization crisis due to deficiency of demand, and if you solve that via increasing wages, you may well run into a different crisis of profit squeeze. But I'm afraid we're not quite there yet, given the secular fall in the share of labor in the last three decades. So I'm more concerned about solving the realization crisis at the moment. Mm. Thank you very much for your attention and patience. And look forward to comments.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Okay. I'll begin with your comments, Joe, if we may.
Sure. Thanks very much to Mark, first of all, for inviting me, and thanks to Özlem for a very interesting presentation. I'm very sympathetic to what Özlem has presented. I think in particular it's a very clear view and stands in opposition to dominant narratives about flexibilization of the labour force, the requirement for wage cuts and so on. Since this is the Keynes seminar, I'm sure I wouldn't have to repeat Keynes's views on cuts to the money wage as a means back to full employment. But since I am sympathetic to Özlem's presentation, this does make it slightly harder to be a discussant, because one doesn't find it quite so easy to find points of disagreement. I think the most important advance in this paper is twofold. One is the inclusion of developing countries, which has not been done before in such a study of this type. And secondly, the simulation exercise at the end to sort of overcome this micro-macro fallacy about wage cuts to look at the knock-on effects of aggregate demand globally. Victoria Chick pointed out to me the other day a very nice comment by Martin Wolf, who said that with reference to the Eurozone crisis, Germany has gone to war on double-entry bookkeeping. And something similar is being done in arguments about either cutting wages or real exchange devaluation as a way of getting the global recovery going again. So what I think I would like to do is focus particularly on the results for developing countries, because I think these are the novel element of what we've got here. And in some ways they're puzzling, in particular because investment doesn't appear to respond to the markup in the developing countries in the way that it does for the Eurozone and not America particularly, but some of the other countries. They're also a little disheartening in some ways, because it appears that many of the large developing countries are profit-led, implying that we can't have a global recovery without wage workers in the poorer countries taking a hit, at least relatively, if not absolutely. So I was going to introduce some thoughts on these countries and perhaps suggest that perhaps things are not as miserable as the results might suggest, and to just give some ideas as to what might be underlying some of these estimations in terms of structural change and processes of development, which inevitably in any kind of large-scale macro analysis you run the potential of missing such things. So, first of all, I thought I'd talk briefly about the relationship between the markup and income distribution and a couple of subtleties which underlie some of this analysis, which could account for some of the results we've seen. Then talk a little more about the Baduri-Margli model in particular, which underlies this, and talk about the role of capacity utilisation, which of course was the key innovation in the post-Kaletskian or post-Keynesian growth models from the previous Cambridge models. And then I was going to focus a little bit on China, because I've worked myself on China, and of all the results that Oslem presents, China is the one which almost stands out most because of the very, very strongly profit-led, apparently profit-led character of China. While on the topic of Germany, I just note that I spotted as the slide went past that although the Germans are renowned for their thrift and their virtue, they actually had the highest coefficient on the consumption function there, so the highest marginal propensity to consume of all the developed countries, which I thought was interesting. Okay, to go back to Kaletsky very briefly. Kaletsky, of course, argued that prices were a markup on costs, and in contrast to Keynes, he argued that costs tended to be marginal costs tended to be almost constant. Keynes, of course, retained the marginal productivity of labour falling curve. Because of Kaletsky's assumption that marginal costs are constant, this means that for the firm, every unit of output features the same price markup. So for a firm, you can have a situation of this type where you have output, price of sales. If we use W as shorthand for costs, just for the moment, assume all costs are wages, then you get a very neat, as long as you're below the point of full capacity when marginal costs start to rise, as long as you're operating, for example, a point here, then you have a very easy division between wages and profits. And this is the feature of the theory which is being sort of exploited in this analysis. But I thought I'd just point out a few subtleties about this. In addition to labour, of course, raw materials are a cost of production. So Kaletsky always said that the firm's profits were a markup on costs, but costs are labour costs and raw materials. And that always gave him problems when trying to work out aggregate distribution of income. What is the wage share in aggregate income? Because there is a macro issue. As you scale up, then firms are buying from other firms, raw materials, or they may be buying from overseas. And Kaletsky never quite got to the bottom of how do I deal with this problem of going from the micro level to the macro level. And by and large, I think he slightly fudged the question, but he came to the conclusion that essentially the price markup determines the distribution of income at the national level. But there were a number of examples he gave that sort of showed his nervousness about this. One, for example, is that the markup will then depend on the degree of vertical integration. If you have a purely vertically integrated economy, then you have the markup as a pure labour cost markup. But if the degree of vertical integration changes, so the degree of roundaboutness of purchasing from other firms, you potentially could have what looks like changes in the average markup coming from a changing structure of production. You can also get changes in the average markup through aggregate demand effects. For example, if there is an increase in the propensity to consume for whatever reason, then you will have an increase in consumption goods production. Now, if the markup in consumption goods production industry is different to the markup in the investment goods industry, you will then have what looks like at the aggregate level a change in the markup, when in fact neither section of industry has changed the markup of production, but you have a change in composition of output. So what you're dealing with is it an average type of variable which runs the danger of showing multidimensional changes into one index. How does this relate to my point? I think this relates because when we're talking about developing countries, there is the potential that these countries are undergoing fairly fundamental structural changes in terms of the production structure. Shift away from agricultural production to industrial production, shift from consumption-led growth paths to investment-led growth paths and so on. And I think there is a potential there for such multi-dimensionalities to confound some of the estimation econometrics. How am I doing for time? About halfway?
Yep.
Secondly, very briefly, I'll mention Steindl. As Mark correctly pointed out, I do favour the Polish economists, and Steindl made a similar point to the one I just made, but on the income side and the propensity to consume. And what he argued was that because middle-class wages, salaries and so on, tend to be relatively protected, and those people have a lower propensity to consume, when there's a downturn, you have a reduction in true wage income. Those people who genuinely do consume more have a reduction in their income, so the reduction in consumption. What looks like a reduction in the propensity to consume as a whole is actually just a shift in income from, for example, wage workers to salaried professionals, doctors, lawyers and so on, who have nice protected salaries and a tendency to save. And this was where a lot of Steindl's analysis about enforced indebtedness of firms and so on comes from. I'll come back to Steindl when I talk about China, because I think he's useful for understanding China. The Maglin-Baduri model comes out of what's called the Kaletskian growth model, which was a sort of improvement in many ways on the previous generation of Cambridge growth models. You may know all this history. The key problem with the Cambridge growth models is they assumed fixed capacity utilization or fixed employment. You couldn't have an increase in output without a change in the capital stock, for example. So in many ways, they weren't particularly Keynesian, even though they were seen as Keynesian models, you assumed a fixed level of employment. Now, the likes of Dutt and Rothorn introduced the idea of variable capacity utilization, and once you bring this in and you have an investment function which is affected by capacity utilization, and you have a feedback such that at higher rates of capacity utilization, investment is stimulated, you get this accelerator effect. But this led to some debates around the correct form of this investment function. The reason being, the original version argued something like this. Investment is a function of the rate of profit and the rate of capacity utilisation. So an argument that if firms are profitable, then they will expect to be profitable in the future, therefore they will invest. And if capacity utilisation is running at a high rate, then they expect that they are going to have trouble fulfilling demand, so they up their investments and so on. This led to arguments because the rate of profit can actually be decomposed into, in a Kolesnikian world, the markup, so the gap between prices and wages on the previous page, the rate of capacity utilisation, and V, which is the inverse of the capital output ratio. But essentially, it decomposes into the markup, so how much profit are you making on each unit, and the capacity utilisation, so how much output are you producing. You can increase your rate of profit for a given capital stock either by producing output at a fixed markup or by increasing your markup at a fixed rate of capacity utilisation. So the problem is that you then got utilisation twice in this investment function. So Margin and Baduri argued that a better function would be to make it purely a function of the rate of profit but separate that out into the markup and capacity utilisation. One of the reasons they did so is you can show quite easily that this investment function can only generate wage-led growth, because partly because of this double entry of the rate of capacity utilisation. So this is a way of getting around this and allowing for a model which had this interesting ambiguity between profit-led or wage-led growth, depending on the relative effects of investment stimulus from an increase in profits versus the reduction in consumption. So this is the underlying functional form. Now, what makes me slightly worried about the developing country results is that this aspect of the investment function doesn't appear to come out at all in the results. This is a U, not a W. Sorry, that looks like a bit like a W. U is in there, but it's sort of proxied by output, which also makes me slightly nervous, because you don't know if output is changing with a fixed capital stock and therefore changing your rate of profit, or if the two are moving together and therefore your profit is staying the same. So really what we're left with for the developing countries is an analysis of the relative propensities to consume out of income given a change in the wage share, a sensitivity of investment to output, which is somewhat unsatisfactory because you would expect investment and output to be very closely related, particularly for China. If you draw a graph of the last 20 years, investment as a share of GDP looks something like that. There's a decline steadily throughout the 90s, and then it's clear that there's a very strong change of policy to an investment-led growth path, and if you impose output over the top of it, it tracks almost one-to-one. So at that point, it's not entirely clear the causation at work here. Is investment causing output, or is output stimulating investment? And I think this, you can make a similar point about net exports. I mean, we're also seeing a strong, particularly for China, a very strong statistical relationship between net exports and the profit share. But given that, you know, in a Keynesian world, profit of firms is equal to investment, in a Kolesnikian world, it's equal to investment minus saving of households, plus the government deficit, plus the foreign balance, you would expect a higher exports to give you higher profits. So again, I'm slightly nervous about the causation at work, particularly for China. 5 minutes. Okay, I will come on to China and speak a little bit about these results and my interpretation of them, and my interpretation of why it may actually be possible for China to grow in what I think is classified as a wage-led manner. Just to quickly recap Oslem's results. There's clearly a higher propensity to consume out of wages than profits in China. This is fully understandable because Chinese firms essentially retain 100% of profits. They don't distribute any dividends. Private investment was not correlated with the profit share, so M was missing. But in the paper, Oslem points out that in previous studies, when public investment is included, then it does become positively correlated. And this is interesting. So what Auslem has tried to do is separate out for China private investment specifically. Now, that's very difficult. I attempted at one point to try and isolate private versus state-owned investment in China. And the only way you can do it is using the enterprise survey data, but that doesn't cover the whole economy. It covers a subset of firms, and the classification for inclusion in that data set changes over time. So I concluded it was very difficult to really narrow down what is private, what is state-owned investment. The problem is further compounded by the fact that China has moved from being a command economy to a at least partially market-based economy in a very significant way. Therefore, many firms were state-owned, you know, 5 years ago. They're now at least partially privately owned. Problems further compounded by the fact that if you look at ostensibly what are private firms and then you follow the ownership structures, you'll find they're owned by some other holding company and some other holding company. And as you follow it up the tree, eventually you'll find a state company somewhere many, many times. So it's a very difficult distinction to make out, and I wonder if this might be behind some of the story. Why would a rising profit share be associated with high, probably rising growth when you include public investment? I don't have an absolutely concrete conclusion here, but in my own thinking about China, I've gone back to Steindl, and I thought about Steindl's analysis of US capitalism. And what Steindl argues is, for the Depression period, that you can divide the American economy into two sectors broadly: a monopolized big corporate monopoly capital sector — this is where Barron and Swayze took monopoly capital from — and then a sort of a periphery of marginal competitive firms. And what Steindl argues on the basis of sort of national accounting identities is that as the monopolized sector becomes able to impose higher and higher markups and becomes less and less bothered about excess capacity and so on, if it's got excess less and less bothered, becomes more sensitive to excess capacity, it scales back on its investment, you actually get a redistribution of profit income from competitive firms to this monopolized sector, and this acts as a real drag. This was a center of Steindl's analysis of why you had this depression in America. Now, I think you can almost reverse this analysis and say, okay, China has a very large core monopoly capital sector, but it's state-owned, and it clearly behaves very differently to what a private monopoly capital sector would behave like. And if you assume that, and this is a bit of a jump, but if you assume that in some way the state still has a reasonable amount of control in China over these large state-owned corporations, this centre of the economy, then it can act almost as a quasi-fiscal tool. So even in the case of stimulus that you would expect a normal monopolised capitalist system to react negatively against, the scale back in investment giving you a slump, I think in China you almost get the opposite. That's when you saw it very clearly from 2007-2008, when export demand contracted very sharply and the current account surplus started to close. They were able to enact an enormous program of state-driven investment, I would say. I mean, it wasn't state government spending, it was firms, largely state-owned firms, financed by the state-owned banking system. Now, what this does, if you reverse the Steindlian argument, is that instead of profits accruing disproportionately in the monopoly capital sector at the expense of marginal firms, you get the opposite. You get the private sector benefiting from state expenditure. Now, this could stimulate private investment, and it could stimulate private profitability. So I think it's not a full account, but I think we could come up with some sort of multi-sectoral argument for why we're seeing these results for China. I also think that the recent experience gives us hope about the very high export price elasticity because the current account has closed remarkably since 2007, 2008. China's almost back to a balance, and certain quarters has almost been back to balance. And yet by, you know, implementing this investment stimulus, they've counteracted the drop in aggregate demand. So that's not the biggest figure on Oslem's chart was China's export sensitivity, and I'm not convinced. The other reason I'm not convinced is it's a fairly recent phenomenon. It's only since 2003, 2004 China's had this current account surplus, whereas it's had 10% growth for 20 years. Astonishing. What is clear is that China does need to rebalance domestic demand towards consumption. That's another discussion. I'm aware that I'm running out of time. The only final point I would like to make is that I think the exercise at the end, the simulation exercise, as I said, is very interesting. And I think it would be very interesting to chase this further and try and introduce other variables, particularly the government position, because that's the other obvious block of aggregate demand that could be going on behind the scenes here and could be skewing results. I mean, if you have a large expansion of government spending, for example, even at a point when profit margins are rising for whatever, you have an increase in output, your econometrics might tell you you've got a profit-led regime when actually you don't, because you're seeing output react to government spending rather than shifts in income distribution. So I think it'd be very interesting to deepen this analysis and try and bring in some of these slightly more subtle effects, particularly the fiscal position of governments, to try and strengthen the argument further, because I think it's a very important argument, and it's very good that we've got someone like the ILO behind it, because it gives us some visibility, hopefully. So I'll leave it there.